to Sundays with Andy. I'd like to introduce Dr. Michael Kors. He'll be our artist presenter today. Sundays with Andy is an artist-led tour series. It meets at 1 o'clock every Sunday afternoon through the entire run of the exhibition Andy Warhol, The Last Decade. And we're lucky to have Michael Kors here today because he has a dual background in both art and art history. So he'll have a very unique perspective to provide insight for Andy Warhol's work. He earned his bachelor's from Brooklyn College in 1970 and then his master's in fine arts from the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore in 1972. He worked with the art group Art and Language in the mid-1970s, and his work can be found in collections around the world, including the Museum of Modern Art in New York, the Getty Research Institute in Los Angeles, the Victoria and Albert Institute or Museum in London, and the Staats Gallery in Stuttgart. He earned his PhD in the history of art from University College London in 1996, and his recent publications include Conceptual Art, Theory, Myth, and Practice, Ad Reinhardt, and Art, Word, and Image, 2,000 Years of Textual Visual Interaction, which will be published in April of this year. So I want to give Michael as much time as possible. Please join me in welcoming Michael Kors.
Thank you. Okay. I just want to say my very esteemed and dear colleague, Fran Culpit from TCU, came today, and one of her essays is in that book on conceptual art, and very glad to see you here today. It's a pleasure to be here. I think if we could sort of move into the front room, we could get started. Okay. We're going to just have a look at these two works here. I don't know if you want me to stand here, I'll do that. It's fine. On the one hand, it's a pretty daunting task. Is that too loud, by the way? It's so spooky to hear you. It's like a disembodied voice, but okay. And I want you to just break in if you have a question, or if you don't kind of get what I'm trying to say here. Just interrupt me, that's fine. It's a pretty daunting task, I think, to talk about Andy Warhol for a number of reasons. First of all, he's probably the most recognized artist of the last century, even though I was told an interesting story by one of the docents earlier. She was getting a lot of calls. People were asking, is the artist going to be at the opening? It's okay. Some of my students have the same approach to art history. Not a problem. Okay. So here you have somebody who's been in the public eye virtually ever since he made the transition from commercial art to the world of, let's just call it high art for the moment, but we're not going to keep with that designation. This starts to happen in the late 50s. By the early 60s, he starts to find his way in to the world. And of course, he had a couple of false starts there. Early on, he started copying cells from comic strips, just like Roy Lichtenstein. And when he saw Roy Lichtenstein's work at Castelli Galleries, he gave up that avenue of work. He thought, that's not going to work out for me. His early work was screen prints of dollar bills, and of course the Campbell soup can series, which I think he first showed at the Ferris Gallery in Los Angeles, a series of 100 of these small paintings, which could have been gotten for a song. In fact, they were bought and then returned because the collector really just couldn't enjoy them fully. The idea is that he was making a move into high art by using certain kinds of subject matter. Now, everybody knows that. Everybody associates Warhol with pop art, with subject matter that is drawn from the general consumer culture, and everyday things. So there's no real problem, we think, with what we call in art the question of iconography. What does the image represent? Aside from what it's portraying, what's its symbolic meaning? For Warhol, perhaps there are quite a number of layers to this which only get revealed as we look at his work over time, which is why this is a very interesting exhibition. because it's going to raise some very surprising questions about Warhol's work that might go against what I'd call the standard interpretation or understanding of it. Now, that might be summarized rather crudely as he's an artist who's about surfaced, he's an artist who's about publicity and celebrity, he's an artist of our times who shows us the common culture that we work in and live in and think about and that influences us. He's an artist about consumption, about the new, about a constant progression of new products, about always moving and always changing. He's the absolute chameleon of the art world, and it's all there to see. There are no secrets. There's no depth to Andy Warhol. That's part of the received view. Increasingly, people are coming to see that as quite a misunderstanding. Not simply because the longer an artist is around to look at, the more we pile on complex interpretations, just because it's fun to do. I mean, there is a kind of a rule of thumb in art criticism and art history that probably started around the 1960s, mid-1960s. The less there is to look at, the more there is to write about. The larger the text, when you have a piece that has very little incident, very little detail, seems to be apprehensible in one go completely. And that's what Warhol seems to be like. But there are some subjects here, the shadow paintings, The Last Supper, the collaborations with Basquiat and Clemente, the oxidation paintings, the Rorschach paintings, that seem to kind of interrupt that. First of all, they're not usual subjects that we would associate with Warhol and the pop era. And secondly, they seem to be rendered in a way that's kind of pushing us back from a superficial interpretation, just looking at the surface. They're presenting us with these objects because they're enigmatic to some extent, take on another kind of meaning, another sort of layering of meaning. Recently, an art historian said, when we look at Andy Warhol, we're really looking at three things, or I won't say people, but certainly three bodies of knowledge. The first is the biographical, the story of the artist. And as Warhol's reputation grows, more and more work is done by historians, dredging up things, finding more things, and therefore creating more complex pictures of what we might call causality. How can we explain how Warhol got from here to there? What was it in his life? Because they're always very tempted to draw quite a direct relationship between an artist's biography and the work they do. That might not be actually true, but it's something that we learn to do, that we're encouraged to do. In Warhol, it's very interesting because some of the things that really formed the story of his life coming together now and becoming revealed to us now are actually very important in understanding where he's coming from. So, for example, when we go and look at The Last Supper, you might think in general, oh yes, Warhol was raised a Catholic. But he was from an Eastern Orthodoxy, a very different experience than the Roman Catholic Church. It certainly impacts on our understanding of the way he portrays portraits, the way he portrays fictional and real people as icons, and what the icon means for that kind of system of belief, what the whole environment of the Eastern Church meant as an evocative place to look at these pictures of things that were both real and unreal. There's also the sense that we have a very graphic way of dealing with things in Warhol that relates directly from his work as a commercial artist. Very quick mechanical procedures, the use of serigraphy or silkscreen combined with painting to create a vast body of work, and then only later a return so-called to the hand, which some people make a lot out of, but is not really important because the way Warhol is doing his very last pieces by hand, by projecting an image onto a blank canvas and then outlining it, the style, the way that he works with material looks as if it could be a kind of silkscreen or a kind of semi-mechanical process. Even in his very earliest illustrations for fashion, the famous series of shoe illustrations, he did these using a monoprint ink blot technique. In fact, his mother helped him a lot with this. He would tell her what to do on this very absorbent paper, and then he would place other paper on it and rub it and create a monoprint of the drawing to create this. So there was always a sense of some kind of mechanism, some kind of manufacturing process that cut against the grain of the fine artist as it was received. We think of him as being cool when in fact some of his most famous series of works, for example, Marilyn series, the Jackie Onassis Kennedy series, the death, the car crashes, the disaster, Saturday Night Disasters, the electric chair series, all of these are very somber, serious projects that reflect on death. They're all memorials of one sort of another. And it's quite important, the sort of image that he selects for these. So we've got all of this mixed up in that first Warhol, and that kind of bleeds in a little to the second Warhol, which is the persona of Andy as the artist who is an absolute victim of consumer society, who is completely enthralled to all the fascinations, all of the kind of exotic pulls that consumerism sort of projects onto us and gets us enmeshed in. So that Andy is simply reporting what's going on. That's one persona that he has. And then the third persona is his work outside of what we called high art, his non-elite artwork, his work as a filmmaker, as a television producer, as an organizer of bands like the Velvet Underground, as a publisher with Interview magazine. All of those areas that take him outside of the world of art. Those three things are kind of mixed up, and I raise them because of the way the superimposition of the portraits here just suggest that there is no one personage to fix upon. And I think that's a quite important thing for Warhol, to develop a conversation and a play between persona and not necessarily never to give anything away, but what's happening is a result of that conversation. You may think you're seeing just a particular shadow, in fact, but you're seeing something that's coming out of a very intense dialogue that he's having. He's having it with himself, he's having it with history, he's having it with the culture at large. So these kinds of off-register portraits do double duty. They provide us with a very nice bit of symbolism about something that has a dynamic identity that can't be fixed, but also talks again about the mismatch, a sort of incompetence in the face of this very simple process of screen printing. If you know about screen printing, you know sometimes it's absolutely essential when you do multicolor work to do multiple passes on the same substrate, on the same canvas or the paper. And registration is very important because misregistration is considered to be a mistake and it ruins the work and you throw it away. But Warhol exploits misregistration very, very early on as a way of saying, I'm going to throw out that sense of competence and expertise in craft and this is what we're going to get. And that even creates a problem when you talk about mass-produced culture, because the essence of mass production is homogeneity. Everything is the same. And he said this, you have a Coca-Cola in Moscow, it's the same Coke that you drink in Washington, D.C., that you drink in Buenos Aires, or you drink in Sydney. It's the same thing. So that kind of sense of the process of manufacture leading to a uniformity becomes askew in Warhol. So he uses one thing whose purpose is to kind of suggest uniformity, and he constantly interrupts it. Okay, so that's a little bit about some of the framework that we could consider when we look at his pieces. I think we should move over to the other side of the gallery and have a little chat about shadows first. These are four panels from a work that, while not infinitely extensible, could cover three walls of this gallery, with each panel butted next to each other. I've seen that installation at the Dia Beacon in New York, and it's extraordinarily powerful because then you get a much larger variety of color run. He introduces these hues at various points, but it's essentially the same image. This is an image of a shadow that's being cast by some sort of cardboard construction. We're not quite sure what that looks like. The way he produces this work is by taking the photograph of the shadow, making a screen for it, and then laying that down on top of a canvas that's already, as Ronnie Catrone put it, been mopped with a lot of paint. So it's important to know that there's a number of ways in which his process of making the art changes. Basically, there's paint put down and then a screen print laid over that when that's dried. Or he'll do that and then come and do some other touches on top of it, which is what he was doing with some of his earlier screen printing works, especially the portrait pieces. So there's always a kind of a working and a reworking there, and there's quite a complex layering of the image itself. But what, in fact, is a shadow? A shadow could be described as a hole in light. Shadows were very, very important to painters of the Renaissance for a number of reasons. Leonardo wrote a fantastic treatise on shadows. They were important for two reasons. First, in terms of the way they modeled things like drapery, they were sort of working against the inheritance of the Byzantine or very flat and stereotypical style. But also it had something to do with cast shadows as well. So we have the shadows that we associate with physical objects that give us a sense of their modeling, their three-dimensionality on a two-dimensional plane. But also we have a sense of a study of the shadows that are cast. And cast shadows also raised considerable amount of interest amongst painters, particularly painters of the 18th century. Diderot wrote as well a number of articles in the encyclopedia on shadows and their structure, because a shadow is just not a singular dark patch. It has an umbra, a penumbra, it has color, it has a structure, and every kind of effect, every kind of situation of the projected shadow or the cast shadow yields a different kind of depiction, demands a different kind of depiction from the artist. So a lot of 18th century artists were very keen to show this. And somehow the shadow was connected to some sense of the Enlightenment philosophically. The shadow was something that gave us a sense of the objectivity of the material world, that separated the world as it was from our ideas of the world. In fact, there's a wonderful book by the historian Michael Baxendall, which indeed is titled Shadows and the Enlightenment. And it's quite an interesting book because Baxendall is a very interesting historian. It's a fairly accessible book too, so don't be afraid to pick it up. and have a look at it. So there's a lot more to the shadow than meets the eye. It's certainly about a lack, it's certainly mysterious, and these are paintings of a kind of mystery. But what the shadow is, for everything that says in this painting, there is an absence, there is an implied presence. And that sense of one thing bringing another thing into being, into mind, without having to be present in the same place, is a very potent idea. It's an idea we find in much of the ideology of the modern period, but specifically we find it in philosophy, politics, and religion. Somebody described philosophy as the science of disappointment. Why do we philosophize? Because the world isn't as we want it to be, and there's a lack in the world. Why are politics important? Because the world isn't as we want it to be, and we want to structure it differently. Why is religion important in that respect? Because, again, we're looking for something that doesn't exist in the world as we live it. And to some extent, I'm starting to look at the shadow paintings as a bit of a signal from Warhol that he's interested in that as well. And this for me is important because if you just look at his work as being about consumer objects and about everything that we all understand, then you're going to miss what I think is the tremendous pathos of Warhol, the sense that you can paint a soup can and maybe 20 years later look at it as a tragic figure. So yes, this is what we see. This is a surface that is constructed for us daily. This is what we engage with, have communication with all the time without thinking. And yet, what a tragedy that this is all there is. So it's that pathos that opens up a big gap for Warhol and allows him to insert his native deep religious feelings into everything he does. So a portrait looks like an icon. A portrait of a dead person is the icon being the picture and the existence of the being. There's this kind of very strange relation. It's not a representation. An icon is not like saying, I am depicting somebody. It is actually held in the mind as the real thing and the image of the thing at the same time. So there's this mystery of absence and presence, which the shadows start to deal with. The self-portrait here, the scale of it, it's beyond the intimacy of portraiture. It has an imperial scale, so it has the sense of an historical painting. It's a fairly disturbing image. The colors tend to be garish. Black background, again, is a color of mourning, placing Warhol as an icon. But this is like a picture of Warhol as living death. And indeed, when he has the prince there on the back wall with the skull atop his head, he's engaging in a very long tradition of the vanitas, of saying all that we have is simply dust before us, and as we will become nothing. So again, it's opening up the space for a discussion about what's missing? Where do I find it? Let's see how it plays out in the next gallery. These two people have graciously... No, please stay. That's good. I like that. Because you've agreed to be our wonderful prop there. A Rorschach blot painting. Again, the scale is enormous. This is not a size that the psychiatrist or social worker can pull out of her briefcase and flash before you and say, what do you see there? What's happening? Rorschachs are interesting for many reasons, but formally, I'll talk about their bilateral symmetry. They can be conceived of as a mirrored diptych. And we all know that Warhol was very interested in diptychs. In his Marilyns, in his Disaster series, he often has diptychs with slightly different kind of rendering of the image on one side than the other, or sometimes he supplants the image on one panel with a monochrome, which is simply a single color, as if to say something is waiting to be impressed or something has left. And we'll see in The Last Supper, we'll see a diptych as well. So the diptych has very interesting and significant importance for Warhol. The importance is that it allows him to develop a conversation within a picture, if I may call it that. They're not necessarily pictures, but just for the moment. The Rorschach is also interesting because it's a field of interpretation. It's a field of dreams. It's a field of fiction, self-invention. And that, of course, relates again to this idea of the artist as chameleon and also the proper orientation that one might have to a culture that demands new, adapt, do everything just in time. What would be the psychic landscape that would find that kind of existence agreeable and even flourishing, you know, as a kind of a nurturing environment? How do you live and grow in a culture that demands that from you? So clearly we have a lot of displaced anxiety, a lot of sublimation possible about where does identity reside? Does identity exist at all anymore in the sense that we are used to thinking of it as a kind of an immovable, actually essential core of being? For Warhol, you can't find it anywhere, but what you keep on finding is this insistence that there is a way out, which is not quite as well developed as the cage that he seems to put us all in, but it exists nevertheless. Part of that is both mind and body, which may be a strange thing to say, but when I look at this work, this is one of the Oxidation series, and this one on my left. If you don't know how they're done, there's metallic paint placed on canvas, and then a number of people are invited to urinate on the canvases, and the chemical reaction between uric acid and metal, whether it's copper or a bronze metallic paint, is to create this oxidation. And you know, when copper oxidizes, it turns from that beautiful yellowish shine to green. And so that's what you're actually seeing here. And similarly with that panel. This is a kind of a portrait too. This is about the body. It has a linked relationship to the body. So you don't see a picture, but you see something that's attached to it. It's like the figure of speech where you would call the queen or the king of England the crown. The crown is not part of their body, it's something associated with them. But it forms a chain of meaning that gets you from A through B to C. So it's a very displaced kind of picture of the body. But it is the body, and therefore it has something to do with this notion of the flesh, which is transient, and for Warhol, as we see, is always shadowed by death and dissolution. So everything that's new and shiny, all the commodities that we have, are really a masquerade, a screen, a sublimation, a defense against the knowledge that everything is actually decaying all the time. And one of the foremost contemporary artists that has gotten the most out of Warhol, and I'm talking about Jeff Koons, in his very early work, exhibited brand new vacuum cleaners and floor polishers in wonderful plexiglass cabinets illuminated from the bottom. And he called these things generically the new, Or, you know, the whole thing was they've never been used. They're pristine. And everybody would say, oh, yeah, here we go, Duchamp and the ready-made again. But it was too late just to repeat that exercise in art. It was about investing it with something else, something that Duchamp never had in mind as the originator of the gesture, but something that Koons could work at, having assimilated Warhol's understanding of the relationship of the commodity to our existence. In this part of the gallery, you've got a very large camouflage painting and a group of paintings here that I'm not terribly familiar with, but they're very interesting nonetheless, the yarn paintings. I actually have a friend in Britain who is doing paintings of knitting that she's taken apart. And I could only guess that this is one of Warhol's further thumbing of his nose at abstract expressionism because of the way the network and the skeins look so much like they could be a flattening, a reduction of Jackson Pollock's all over drip painting. So there's a very obvious reference, but they're being done with yarn. I'm not sure how he did it. I imagine that yarn was dipped into paint and then something was done and photographed and screen printed in a variety of colors all on top of one another. But the issue is that this also refers to the body in a certain way, but also quite indirectly. The abstract expressionists were famous for their macho stance, and I don't want to simplify this too much, but Warhol was not a macho man. Warhol was the opposite. Warhol was a camp follower. He was gay, and he made no bones about it. And he surrounded himself with people, part of his social world, that would be a world inimical to the likes of the abstract expressionists. And even we used to have an expression, us conceptual artists, we used to refer to the painters of the 60s as the hairy-chested painters. And I think Warhol continues to do that because he's interested in puncturing that particular myth and making room for something in between. Okay, so I see it also as a kind of a reference to a body. This is a sort of spread out thing. Taken together, you could create an argument about it that's much more interesting than, in my view, just looking at it as the subject. And isn't that pretty? Isn't that decorative? Warhol always catches us. He's always dangling the bait that he knows we will bite, that we'll take. But the sting of the hook is really what makes Warhol an interesting artist. Not that he's so facile, but that he's going to yank you away from your comfort zone about what the world is like and what objects and art in the world could be like. The camouflage is probably the most straightforward of his statements. I mean, it is what the chameleon is. And these come relatively late in his career. Another interesting thing about actually having an exhibition that's titled The Late Warhols is that we tend to look at the late works of artists, and of course, one never knows when their late works are being made. Right? Warhol, who was absolutely a hypochondriac and deathly afraid of doctors and hospitals, had such foreboding when he went into surgery for this gallbladder operation. I mean, he had escaped death after Valerie Solanas tried to assassinate him, and it just completely destroyed his entire body. So he was absolutely fearful of that. But these late works, which kind of begin some years before his rather untimely death at the age of 59, start to look at his earlier works as a kind of an inventory that's available for reworking. This is something that happens quite a lot in art. People go back to earlier themes, take them up, and see if they can extend them. But what he's doing in his late works, I think, is kind of opening up this area that we've been talking about and trying to present it in a richer way. And the camouflage was really a kind of interesting position for him, certainly because of its association with the military and the way that he treats it as this overall pattern. So again, you have this paired with that, which gives us a multitude of references. Even Jackson Pollock, what has he got to hide in all his drips? And there are plenty of people who'll talk about Pollock as a repressed homosexual. What do we have to hide, and can we hide it? And what's the virtue of the camouflage? It's the surface, but it's a very particular surface. It's an active surface. How many kinds of camouflage can a chameleon have? Well, you just look at the whole series here and look at the different array of colors. So while it's interesting for some people to remark how the colors are not the usual military colors, it's what we'd expect. Because really, it's about the format, the motif, and just cycling it through as many variations as we have the energy to produce. Let's go into this further gallery and talk about eggs. Well, all right, something. You've got a great opportunity here to see how the architecture of a museum should work. Because I think the people who installed this show understood that very well. If you just turn around, you're facing a Rorschach icon. It's on a golden field, isn't it? Just like Byzantine and Greek Orthodox icons are. They're on the golden field because the gold is the otherworldly. And then you have this one, which is much more lyrical seeming and very much a painterly gesture, even though it's completely automatically produced. And here you get to see, I think, a little bit more of what I was talking about in terms of the notion of the diptych for Warhol. Because you get a very distinct difference between the left-hand and the right-hand section of the Rorschach test. Something that you don't get with the icon, which is really like a symbol on a ground. So they're the same subject, they're generated in the same way, but they have very different meanings. They're kind of, again, pulling apart the semantic structure, the structure of meaning that Warhol is able to create with this. But what's really interesting is how we have the eggs now. And I can't help but thinking of the eggs on the left as Easter eggs. But even the eggs on the right, eggs just as eggs, are potent symbols of rebirth or of the universe, the cosmology of the cosmic egg. This appears in a lot of the originary myths of a lot of pagan beliefs. Christianity takes it over, the myth of the eternal return, the resurrection, and all of that. So we're never far again from this sense of longing, this way to kind of salve the disappointment of actual life that Warhol is experiencing, I think, profoundly throughout his life. And if we just return for a moment to his biography, I would think that we would consider him to be the quintessential outsider, growing up in Pittsburgh with all of these ideas that have no place to go in that sort of milieu, gravitating to New York. He actually was rooming with a wonderful figurative painter, Philip Perlstein, who he had met at Carnegie Mellon, where he went to art school. Going to New York, making his way, still feeling the outsider. He was training as an artist. Why did he go into commercial art? What was happening there? And then finally breaking into art and sort of saying, great, but I'm still not happy. In a way, there was never a place for Warhol to rest. There was never a way for him to overcome that initial trauma, that initial situation that he found himself in. And if biography has anything at all to do with Warhol's work, it's certainly something like an acting out of this particular trauma. But the thing that we love about Warhol is that he wasn't doing it as an individual who was an enigma, who was obscure. He was doing it as somebody who we would see as every man. Because he was using the visual means that engage all of us. And that is part of the brilliance. Whether that was something that he had planned or not, I don't think so. I think it was just the way he thought about getting things out. It was that kind of generosity of spirit, because he could have gone in the opposite direction. And a lot of artists of his generation did, like Paul Tech, a number of people who gravitated towards the bizarre, the strange, the unhealthy. You know, think of Kenneth Anger and his films and his relationship to Aleister Crowley and demonism, Satanism, all of that. So there's this boiling up of strange, you know, I can't fit in, what can I do? The easiest way to fit in is to open myself up and to say, that's all there is, and everything around me is what I'm going to have. There's the surface. We could all understand that. We go on. But here is the residue of that acting out again and again. Okay. See if we could find what I'm looking for here. Let's pass this one. We're going to come to another set of collaborative works. Are interesting. This gallery is good. Yeah. We'll just have a look at. Oh. We'll just have a look at this Marilyn. This is great because it disappears. That's wonderful. I think where my speaker is, this is sort of like roaming the halls with an IV. Can't get too far away from it. Thank you. Not that I've ever roamed a hall with an IV, but so I just wanted to stop briefly to consider this quadruple portrait of Marilyn. It recapitulates the earlier Monroe portraits. In the catalog, they do a good job of explaining the origin of the image of Monroe that Warhol selects. It's from a publicity still from the film Niagara from the 50s. So nothing contemporary with her death. But something where the position of the head, the gaze, and everything is much, much more interesting to produce as an iconic portrait rather than something suggesting some kind of joie de vivre or sexual allure, whatever. And black on black, of course, that's wonderful because it's a kind of a memorial. But also it has this property of faintly disappearing as you walk across it. So it's not just meant to be looked at frontally. And I suspect that people feel they can go through this exhibition very quickly. What I'm trying to do is plant the seeds to slow you down. Again, you're not necessarily going to see in the detail, but you're going to be working and conversing with the imagery, with the iconography, with the process, as much as there is. I mean, that is modern and contemporary art, whether we like it or not. That's what artists do. So this is a very interesting return to Marilyn, even more accentuating that kind of loss. And he's returning in the same period to some of his earlier works. As he said, he sort of got an interest in painting again, painting by hand. But as I mentioned, there's not necessarily a great deal of difference between these and what he could do with one of the misregistered screen prints. He's also starting to collaborate. This was put together by the Swiss dealer Bruno Bischofberger, and I remember seeing the collaborative works, especially with Jean-Michel Basquiat in New York at Tony Shafrazi Gallery in, I think, 1984. And they came at a very interesting time when Basquiat's star was on the rise and Warhol, believe it or not, was kind of scuttling around closer to the bottom than he'd ever been. A lot of people imagine that from the late 70s or even the mid 70s to virtually the time of his death, that he was simply a court painter for the nouveau riche. You could buy the portrait, you can commission the portrait by Warhol, you know, first for 10 grand, then for 40 grand, then for 100,000. But that he was working with that kind of patronage. People didn't understand or weren't particularly interested in the subject matter that he was dealing with. The series that we saw, the mythology series based on the Hollywood icon, which actually reminded me when I took my daughter to see Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief with the Olympians. Only a Brit could write a screenplay referencing the pantheon of gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. The Hollywood gods and goddesses are the ones that would be most acceptable, and those are the ones that Warhol actually embraced. And his large portraits of Mao, and then he's getting into the Last Supper. People really didn't understand it. So this moment, this opportunity to collaborate with a rising star coming out of street art and graffiti, as Jean-Michel Basquiat did, was a particularly interesting one for Warhol. And I love it because Basquiat is notorious for overpainting so much of what Warhol had put down. And it seems like Warhol always had the first shot, which was like the sucker place. And again, Basquiat is working on it. I don't know the dynamics of the production of this, if there was a back and forth, a revisiting. I suppose there could have been. Not a problem there. But it's very interesting to get these different takes on the same cultural field. Basquiat started life as a graffiti artist, working with two other people in New York, and he had a tag that was called SAMO, S-A-M-O, which could have been short for same old, or same old, expletive deleted. And he and his friends would put these slogans all over Soho, which was the center of the gallery scene in New York at that time, that were very critical of consumer culture. They were fairly political in their edge, and they were just everywhere. And they've been documented very well by the guy who really invented the term conceptual art. What's his name? The mathematician and country musician. It'll come to me. But very interesting guy. He created a portfolio of all of these images. So that's where Basquiat's coming from. Then Anina Nosey, another dealer in New York, locks him in her basement for a month, gives him drugs, art materials, whatever, and he produces his first show, which is hailed as miraculous, a masterpiece, a child prodigy. He bursts on the scene, and then he's dead within a decade. So it always seems like Warhol was outliving all of his guests. And when, in fact, Lou Reed and John Cale got together to write and produce that album, Songs for Drella, there was very much, not implicit, but very explicit commentary in the songs about Warhol's kind of vampire-like quality in terms of bringing people in who were quite lost, eccentric, interesting, creative, but effectively dependent, and what he did with them and to them. And the album, which is it's a good thing to revisit because it's a kind of it's an archive. It's like a source matter for looking at Warhol. because these are people who worked with him. They were members of Velvet Underground, as you probably know. They talked about his obsessiveness, his workaholic attitude, and all of that. And I think one of the features of workaholism is it's another kind of sublimation. It's a way of trying to hold back time, and constantly filling time with something. So again, it's interesting. Here we have something that is edging towards a kind of a horror vacui. And you could see that in the Clemente and Warhol and Basquiat. Everything is covered. Very layered, conversations going on and on and on. And then you start getting work from Warhol, which is very open and very empty. And I think we'll kind of lead into this room and sort of wrap it up. Yes, Henry Flint. Thank you. Gosh, I was thinking George Brecht. No, that's not one. Henry Flint. Yeah, excellent. Thank you. Right. According to the wall text, this painting reveals Warhol's religious beliefs. What I've been saying the past 45 minutes is, yes, but there isn't one of Warhol's paintings that doesn't reveal his religious beliefs. If we understand religion as that insertion into the gap of disappointment, we're not talking about particular doctrinal theology here. We're talking about an idea, an existential consequence of how we think and live as human beings. And of course, pulling it out of Da Vinci is great because, like all of the other mass-produced objects that Warhol was depicting, this is one of the most reproduced images in the world as well. And it comes to us not as high art, but most frequently as a variation of kitsch. And that's important for Warhol because I think he wants to say we welcome kitsch in, just like we welcome all the other differences that his life embodied and the people that he worked with embodied. Behind us we have yet another reinterpretation of that. Again, this conversation between Warhol and Basquiat, where Basquiat just kind of puts all his cards on the table and starts to insert these wonderful images that simply don't fly, but in a way they do. So on the canvas, we can reduce everything to the same ground. And as I think, a lot of the subjects that Warhol has reached for, he's tried to lay low. He's tried to flatten them. Because it's important that we have this continuous Mobius strip of culture, that there is no hierarchy between high and low. That's a false distinction. That's, I guess, a defense that doesn't really pan out. It doesn't hold. And in the final room, where there'll be the video interrupting, but that's okay because it's probably appropriate that that happens. This is a detail from the Last Supper. This is the head of Christ, and it's repeated 112 times. There's no reason why it's 112. It could be 25, it could be 300. The fact that the image is cut off at this margin says to me that Warhol wants you to see this as an infinite series, that we're just taking a random slice through an infinitely repeating series of heads of Christ. Mondrian does this as well in his grid paintings of the late 20s and early 30s, where you're not really looking at a picture as if you're looking through a window, but you're looking at something that could be extendable in all directions infinitely, and we're just getting a portion of it. Sometimes he'll extend those vertical and horizontal bars all the way to the edge of the canvas. Sometimes they stop short, maybe only a quarter of an inch, but they're definitely not at the edge. So you might have hit a kind of a dead end on that existential plane. But the idea of repetition as suggesting infinity is very important, because there's a different kind of idea of repetition than repetition suggesting mass production and uniformity. And yet, there's even a third idea of repetition, which I really like, which I haven't discussed, but which surely has to come into play here, and that is the repetition of ritual. And we will tend to associate ritual with religious practices, but that's not the only place in our culture where ritual actually resides. It happens in political functions, state functions, the military, rites of passage, any kind of codified set of behavior that's repeatable, and that works as a model. That's our contemporary ritual. That's our cultural heritage. And ritual, again, is the thing that you do to interrupt time, to make time timeless. And this timelessness carries throughout. I mean, these could be 112 Campbell soup cans. We wouldn't quite get it then, but we get it now. And I think Warhol, being really brilliant at running a joke and then revealing the punchline at the end, decides, okay, I can reveal this now. This will be very interesting, because that's just going to turn everything else on its head. And I love to do that. That's my job as an artist. And certainly getting back to this sense of where you fit in. You thought you knew where I fit in. I didn't fit in there. Here's a surprise. And he leaves us with that. And then he dies. And that's what we got. So it's the end of the story, whether we like it or not, but I think it's a pretty good story, nevertheless. And thanks for coming with me on this little journey through Warhol's late works. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them. Michael Corris, Corris, C-O-R-R-I-S. Okay. Oh. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay.